Okay, so today our topic is a bit of hardware security, and we had a paper about a cryptographic secure coprocessor, and might as well ground that paper with a picture of the actual device they were talking about. This is what it looked like when it was commercially released. You can see that it, looking at it, doesn't tell you very much because everything's in, that's besides some batteries, are encased within this very opaque container. So, start talking about hardware security. Let's talk about sort of different topics in ways hardware cares about security. So one, and probably the longest lived kind of hardware security that's still very important, is protecting software from other software. And this is a lot of what our processors need to do. A lot of the resources are devoted to this because we have like page tables, which mean that we have a TLB in every memory lookup. And that's to support protecting software from software. And we have these mechanisms, which have been around for a very long time, since like the 60s, for allowing an operating system to have to keep run applications that are isolated from the operating system in each other. There's also sort of a secondary topic, which sometimes seems to receive attention in the hardware community, sometimes not, which is helping people produce code which doesn't have security flaws, doesn't have bugs which allow an adversary to make the code do bad things. So helping people produce code that will at least, if it behave incorrectly in a more controlled way. And there's this third category, which is what the paper we were looking at today is about, which is protecting code from people who have access to the hardware, which is a very different sort of thing. And maybe there's a fourth category you might mention briefly, which is verifying that hardware does what you think it does. So, to start out, I'm going to mention some major comments on the papers and to bring up before we move on to sort of more general security topics. So one question a lot of people had is, how do you use this secure coprocessor? What is it useful for? Why do you want this instead of a dedicated machine that is just a normal computer? Why do you want all these extra features, which seem pretty expensive, both possibly having a performance penalty and certainly being harder to manufacture and a lot harder to maintain? On this coprocessor, if you want to upgrade the CPU, you have to open up a secure container that is not designed to be opened. Can't really do it. It seems like we made some pretty big compromises. So I'll give some examples of classic use cases. So one use case for various sorts of secure coprocessor is authentication tokens. So I have on my Keyring this small device here, which is an authentication token, which I can use to log into various web services. And the idea is that you can't take that device from me and make a copy of it. That you can't get, it has some secrets on it that you can't get off it, even if you have physical access to it. Now, this is a $10 or $20 secure coprocessor, so it's a lot less secure than the sort of device described in the paper you read for today. In particular, the sort of adversaries they're thinking of, the sort of resources that they're assuming their attackers will bring to the device can do a lot more and would have no trouble with the sort of device in my keychain. But we have this basic goal that we want confidence that no matter what bad things the device ends up doing, that at least the secrets on the device haven't been stolen. That at least we know that when we get the device back under our control, that it's not continuing to use those secrets to authenticate as me somewhere. I know if I have the device, I'm the only one using that to authenticate, that there's not some copy of the device somewhere. And this is useful in, for example, banking, where if you have something which, say, allows you to do an ATM transaction, or allows you to figure out pins from an encrypted pin somewhere, that you don't want some nefarious banking employee to make a copy of that secret key and then then get a copy of your PIN database and know all the PINs for all the ATM cards. And banks would like that sort of assurance, and these devices can help give it to them because they know that even though someone might have access to the machine room where this device lives, they can't just plug something into the device and take the data out, because the device physically doesn't allow that. Another classic example is certificate authorities. So on the web, we have authorities which identify that, yes, you're really talking to bankofamerica.com. And one of the requirements for operating a certificate authority is that you use a device like the one we had described in this paper to control your private key. So you know, you have an accurate log because of these devices of everything that was signed. And you can verify that you did not say anything was bankofamerica.com that you don't think you did. That you know that with very high confidence that that didn't happen, because someone would have had to steal this device and break it in order for you to be missing something from your logs and not know it. Okay. So any questions on these sorts of use cases? And something which is not mentioned in the paper, but a common name for the sort of device that you might see when you're in industry or if you read other papers, is a hardware security module. So the device IBM describes is often called a hardware security module, and you'll see there are competitors to IBM who build other hardware security modules, and the security of them is rather an interesting question, because most of the manufacturers do not tell you nearly as much as IBM told you about what they actually do. And some people think that this is a problem. Why do they tell us so much about the architecture? Doesn't that help attackers? And maybe it does. But a problem with hardware security is that it's really hard to tell that they really did the things they were supposed to do. So, for example, IBM claims to have zeroizing machinery. Like, with other manufacturers, you don't even know if they really claim to have that. Like, if they're not releasing those sorts of details. Presumably, they try to release some details, but, not knowing things, might just leaves you in a kind of awkward position where you have to hope that they're doing that their assessment of your security needs is right. Okay, so let's go back to our various categories of hardware security and look at this first category. And review some things we've touched on a little in this semester about sort of classic ways to protect software from software. And also maybe look a bit about what IBM did for their specialized device that's a bit different than what we do in a normal computer. So the key way that normal computers protect software from software is something that's sometimes called dual mode operation. That we have some sort of kernel mode or supervisor mode, or there's tons of names, but some mode where there's privileged instructions that do special things, like setting page tables or disabling interrupts or talking directly to I/O devices. And these only work in kernel mode, which is what typically we think of the operating system as running in, even though that's not entirely true. And the kernel mode can only be entered starting at OS control code. So the operating system gets to guarantee what you can do by making sure whatever code it provides that runs in kernel mode and all those places where you can start running code in kernel mode don't do anything bad. So this is sort of the key idea about how typical computers allow you to run software that can't, no matter what it does, interfere with other software. And often, real hardware has multiple protection levels, which is something you should be aware of though it ends up not being particularly important. So for example, on x86, depending on how you count, there are arguably six different protection levels. And basically, it's kind of like kernel mode or not, but there's some things which allow a few additional operations. And hardware manufacturers have apparently thought that this was useful. So it's something that was commonly implemented, and probably an influential feature on x86 was that Multics, which was a very old and influential operating system from the mid-60s, proposed hardware which had 8 protection rings and had some actual useful way of using them. In practice, typically we use maybe 2 or 3 of these, usually ring 0 and 3 and maybe hypervisor mode. And some special BIOS software might run in system management mode. But this is sort of the thing which exists. And the reason we don't actually need any of those extra protection levels is that at some little extra cost, we can emulate them with more. So if we have a program, a guest OS, and a virtual machine monitor, let's say, and let's say we don't have a ring 0 and a hypervisor mode. Say we don't have that sort of extra level, then we can still achieve the same effect as far as programs are concerned. So this stuff will just run in user mode, even though these are conceptually different protection levels. We can run them all in user mode and run our virtual machine monitor in kernel mode. And when we do something like a system call from our program, we can turn that into a call to the user mode code that's in our guest operating system. So what we do is the system call ends up being a system call not to the guest OS like it's supposed to be, but to the virtual machine monitor. So it makes the hardware instruction that says do a system call, and that might always execute code in kernel mode, but that's not a problem because our kernel mode code can make up for the difference. It can actually run the guest OS code for us. So it runs a little handler that first changes the page table to be the guest OS view of memory, so give it extra permissions in that way, and also remember what it needs to do if there's a system call, something that turns in, or from the guest OS. And then it switches to user mode and runs the guest OS handler. So this is what we would expect the processor to do if it really supported multiple protection modes. For us, it might do this all in hardware, but the effect is the same. And for this reason, there's not really much reason to have multiple protection rings, though it's been historically a very popular idea in hardware. And as alluded to with this name hypervisor mode, hypervisor is another name for a virtual machine monitor. So software which runs system virtual machines like VirtualBox or VMware, is that x86 has added some support to make it easier to write virtual machines, which might make this process faster. And if you're careful, you can do that in a way which makes nesting elegant. You can see proposals for doing that. But it's not actually necessary for security. It's just an optimization to make it so you spend less time writing code in this virtual machine monitor mode and spend less time changing the page tables and therefore invalidating TLB entries. So questions about this sort of procedure? This is usually a very confusing diagram for people, even though maybe many of you have seen it in an OS class somewhere. Yes? No? Okay. So the other side of this is that we have page tables. That's the other big part of our most common mechanism for actually allowing operating systems to isolate processes. And remember, our page table is essentially this big table in memory where the index in the table tells us the virtual page number, some part of the program's address. And the value stored in there tells us the physical page number, some part of the actual address in real memory. And entries can be invalid, And we can have permissions on entries to indicate, to allow us to make it so programs can read some data but not write it. And in reality, to implement page tables, we use a hierarchical structure just because having the number of entries to completely fill out this table would be ridiculous. So we have a hierarchical structure, and the reason we save space with this is that sometimes this pointer will just be a pointer to nothing. We'll just say all things with these top 9 bits as, say, zeros are invalid. And that's a choice we can make. So page tables are a classical mechanism. They aren't the only choice. So one thing is you might come across hardware which has segments. That's another way of doing this, where we just have a limit register, and we check a base register and a limit register, and we check that everything is in the range of those two registers. That's much simpler than a page table lookup. So you don't need the full complexity of a page table to do it, but if you take an OS class, you'll see that page tables have a lot of other utility, which is why they're typically what we implement. So there's another, like, completely different approach, I'd like to point out, for doing this sort of memory protection. And so one idea which has been has floated around the architecture community from time to time, which has way fallen out of fashion, are tagged architectures. So we have an architecture that all the ones we're familiar with, you have a value in memory, you just get a value in memory, and it's just a sequence of bits. That's all it is. But you don't have to do that. So one thing we could do is we could say that maybe everything in memory has a type. So in this case, the people in this paper have a single tag which says what type it is. And there's two possibilities. Either it's 0 for not a pointer, or 1 for is a pointer. And what they do is that if you try to use something that's not a pointer to access memory, it fails. And you're limited in the instructions you can use to compose pointers if you're not the operating system. So instructions that actually set an arbitrary pointer are privileged on this architecture. And this is another way of limiting the access, where we still have, we have pointers which construct a real memory address in some way. They have a non-trivial mapping. So they have some bits on the top of the pointer which say, what are our permissions if we're using this pointer, and how much can I change this base address by? But you have to go through things that are marked as pointers, and if you can't get something marked as a pointer from the OS, you can't access that memory. So this is a completely different way than page tables of giving programs access to memory that has sort of an elegant hardware support. That the hardware support is that we have separate pointer manipulation instructions that leave this pointer tag as 1, otherwise you can't, all the load and store instructions just say, sorry, you passed me a number, not a pointer. So this is another sort of approach, and security people might call this a capability-based approach. A capability is a token you have which names an entity and also says you have access to the entity. Which you'll learn a lot more about if you take a security course, probably. So this is another sort of option. Now, tag-based architectures are actually not popular so much historically for security reasons, but because they're thought to be a better way to implement high-level languages. As I said, they've really fallen out of favor, and there are some problems with them. Like, one you can see here is that we seem to be wasting a lot of space that we don't really need to be using. And also, we've made pointer manipulation harder. Yeah?
Can you maybe go a little more detail about high-level languages?
So the idea would be that you could have the hardware. So for the languages I'm thinking of are something like Lisp. Languages where you don't have strong typing, where values like are coerced between types, where you can have the hardware like read a value and know it's supposed to be an integer, and the hardware can do the type checking at runtime for you. is the key idea. So the hard, if you try to read something that's not that's a floating point value as an integer, the hardware will just say, oh, that's an exception. I'll just catch that for you rather than you need to check all the time when implementing a dynamic language like Lisp or Python whether or not you have the right type of value. And as I said, this is falling out of favor, probably because there are much better seeming ways of implementing those languages than requiring hardware support. But if you look at old architectures like the Lisp machine, that was the sort of thing that they were thinking about. I'm not sure where they actually did it. So I showed you our sort of, this sort of protection rings mechanism, and the IBM people, when designing their secure coprocessor, did something similar, but a bit different. So what was one difference between what they did and normal protection rings? What was the big difference? The property many people recognized in their paper reviews. So,
yeah. Maybe overly simplistic, but you can't go backwards.
Yeah, that you can't go backwards. That this diagram is impossible because you can't go back up. Not allowed. Or you can't go down. Like, there's no system call to a higher privilege on their system. Once you leave the highest privilege, you don't go back ever. So anyone have a guess as to why that they thought this might have been a good idea? Not allowing you to go backwards? Yeah.
I guess for security reasons, you don't want potentially going from a low security area back to a high security area part of execution, so you somehow communicate between the two, making so that you are executing high security code, potentially coming in a low security area.
Yeah, so they're worried about somehow low security code setting up something bad happening with the high security code. And we do this all the time in operating systems. And what we depend on in operating systems, which I mentioned earlier, is that when we enter the privilege mode, that it's only OS-controlled code. But in order for that to be correct, we need to know that the OS-controlled code is correctly written. And not that just that it's correctly written, but it's written to handle all the weird things that low-security code might be doing. And that turns out to be really challenging. And that's probably what they were afraid of. So here, with their ratcheting mechanism, they don't need to worry about what miniboot does, miniboot 0 does if miniboot 1 sets up a weird state and runs miniboot 0 because it can't do that. It just can't. So there's no concern you have about needing to deal with all the weird states your code can set up. So that this simplifies reasoning about the security of the system. If they had something like system calls into miniboot 0, they would need to look at the miniboot 0 code really, really carefully and try to figure out whether anything bad happened. It also simplified their implementation of protection. So one thing they had is that they had some fixed region of memory in the battery-backed RAM where whether you could access it or not depended on which ratchet you got to. That if you got to a high enough ratchet, you could not access miniboot 0 stuff, for example, once you got to miniboot 1. And they implemented this with a separate processor. So probably one reason for doing this is that if you look at what they were doing, it kind of seems like they might have a customized processor, but they probably didn't. They probably just used a stock processor, which they enclosed in something, and also and communicated with a microcontroller that was also a normal microcontroller that they could program to implement this policy. So they just use a normal microcontroller to implement this policy. And it's much easier to reason about how that microcontroller works if it doesn't need to figure out what state a separate CPU is in. And having things only go down makes it so you get a signal that, hey, I'm switching privilege, and you know you step down and you never have to worry about synchronizing signals for going back up and going back down. And this sort of simple implementation of these policies, rather than something like page tables, which are relatively complicated but way more flexible, is how they make it easy to reason about, can someone get at my secrets? Your answer, can you get at Miniboot Zero's secrets? Well, all you need to check is that that operation which goes from ratchet 0 to ratchet 1 actually works correctly. And you just need to check that that separate microcontroller, which is arbitrating access to protected page 0, actually does what it's supposed to do. You don't need to check that Miniboot Zero's code is all correct. So this was all a lot about making it easier to verify the software. Not that you couldn't do what they were doing with the traditional architecture of kernel mode and user mode, but just that they wanted it to be easy to verify that they were actually keeping their secrets secret. And similarly, they had a similar idea for how code loading works. That they didn't want to have to spend lots of time verifying that no one modified code when they weren't supposed to. So their policy is that they have this separate microcontroller that's in front of the flash memory that stores their code, which says, if you've gone beyond ratchet 1, I'm not going to let you load any code ever. You can read your code, but you can't write it. And that's how they guarantee, quite simply, that some application can't figure out a way to replace the operating system, because by the time the application gets to run, there's no way for the processor the application is running on to actually write to the operating system code. So any questions about the ratchet mechanism or comments? Okay. So this is it's a pretty simple mechanism, and it makes sense to do this less flexible mechanism when you're so very concerned about security first. They've clearly compromised it for this because, for example, you can like forget about doing jitting in this environment. Not possible. Code loading is pretty awkward. You need to restart the device. But that's a compromise they're willing to make. So I'd like to talk briefly about other sorts of aids in producing vulnerability-free code. And we see that the protection mechanisms in this paper are sort of serve a dual purpose at helping you produce vulnerability-free code. They didn't just rely on the traditional mechanisms because they wanted correctness to be easier to reason about. But there's also sort of hardware features that are pretty common that are designed to just help people make sure their code executes correctly. That has well-defined behavior when it would otherwise do something wrong. So one example of this is that on modern Intel systems, Intel has an extension which is hardware-assisted bounds checking, where if you're accessing arrays that have bounds and you want to make sure you're accessing inside the array and not something else like the return address on the stack or code somewhere or a pointer to a function somewhere, that there are hardware instructions where you can say, hey, I'm accessing this pointer at this offset, tell me if I'm making a mistake. And the way Intel's implementation works is that they have basically a little page table, which looks very much like a page table, except instead of looking up pages, you look up array bounds. So you say, at this memory location, there's an array, and it has this size. It gives you a upper and lower bound for a given base pointer. And you pass a pointer in to some bounds check instruction, and it looks it up, the base and the offset you have, and with this bounce check instruction that says, did you make a mistake? And if so, it does something other than actually access that memory. It triggers an exception, so you get a nice, you had a bounce check problem. And the supposed advantage of this is that this should be faster for the hardware to implement than if you actually wrote out the comparisons and did all the comparisons. So, yeah?
What is the performance, like order of magnitude?
I'm not sure what the claims are. I think it's probably order like 5 or 10%, something like that, or less. And all bounce checking depends a lot on what the compiler can do. Because, so these are, but the bounce checks instructions you'll execute are cases where the compiler can't look at the code and say, that's always in bounds. And what has to happen is the compiler needs to be augmented to add these instructions, and Intel wrote that stuff to do that for GCC and Intel's compiler.
I'd be curious why, like, every server in the world isn't.
And I'm sure the overhead is actually complicated to talk about because, like, there's sometimes a table lookup, sometimes not. So some other examples of this sort of thing. So one that was very big news a while ago is write X or execute. So it used to be the case that commonly, if you had a page table, that you could either if you made a page readable, you made it executable. And this is not so great for buffer overflows because it makes buffer overflows really easy in that you can just write code anywhere, and if you can jump to it, you can execute it. So a simple mitigation, which if you talk to security people, maybe isn't actually as effective as you might think it is, but is that maybe you can add the ability to make it so things are executable or not in the page table. Or at least so that things that are writable in the page table aren't executable. And this is a simple hardware feature that most processors have added now. That making it so if you have memory that's writable, that it can't at the same time be executable. If you want to write something and then execute it, you need to change the page table first. And this doesn't actually change your protection anyways, because you can still do all the same operations, but it helps code not do something dangerous, because it makes it harder for you to accidentally execute code you didn't mean to. Another example of this sort of feature is that some processors, including recent Intel, support trapping to access on user-accessible memory when in kernel mode. So in kernel mode, usually the page table entries have something, you know, have actually in these permissions something about can you access this in user mode or not. And from that, Intel has support for saying, well, if you try to access something that's accessible in user mode, by default, trigger an exception. So you can say, that was probably a mistake. And the idea is that as an operating system writer, you would enable and disable this feature based on when you think you're supposed to be accessing stuff from the user. That only when you're copying something from the user do you enable this, otherwise you don't, and this keeps you from making mistakes, like accidentally jumping to user code in kernel mode, which you never ever want to do. You never want to let the user decide what you run in kernel mode. And this is simple hardware support that prevents the OS from accidentally doing something bad. But it doesn't actually change what privileges the OS has. Any questions about any of these mechanisms? And there's probably more room for research on things like this, where hardware manufacturers can make it easier to have efficient code that, you know, avoids security vulnerabilities. So let's go on to the main topic of the paper, which was protecting code from people with access to the hardware. So this weird idea that I'm going to give you access to a piece of hardware and you're not going to be able to do something with it, despite having it in your hands. And the big thing they were worried about are what they call tampering. Someone trying to make the hardware do something it's not supposed to. And the paper gave this sort of hierarchy of different types of things you do about tampering. So they have tamper evidence, tamper resistance, tamper detection, and tamper response. And being that they wanted to brag about what they were doing, they obviously did the most inclusive one of these. So let's look at what each of these mean. Let's start with tamper evidence. So tamper evidence means that hopefully, if you try to tamper with the device, someone can figure out later that you did it. So an example of an attempt at tamper evidence are these stickers here. So these are steel stickers from voting machines in New Jersey. And if you try to remove this sticker in the obvious way and replace it, you get something like this, where it says open void on it. And the idea is that you need to remove it to access some screws underneath here, and that this should tell you if the machine was tampered with. So can anyone think of some problems with this sort of scheme? Yeah.
Yes, you can try chemical or heat-based ways to remove it.
Yes, so for example, the Appel, who did the study I got these pictures from, apparently used a heat gun. And a heat gun apparently is excellent at removing these stickers and allowing you to replace them without showing any evidence of damage. So are there any other problems with this sort of scheme? Yeah?
You have to think to check the sticker.
Yeah, so you have to think to check that the sticker is there. And not only that, for this to really work well, you need to actually check the serial number. Because the idea is that not only is the sticker isn't changed, like, and that's what the serial number is for. So you know that someone didn't just take a new sticker and put it on there. So you actually not only need to check that the stickers are there, but you need to record the serial number and look at your list of old serial numbers you recorded before and check that they're the same. And this is maybe not something that you might expect an ordinary person helping to run an election in central New Jersey to do, which was a big complaint about voting machine security when this was part of their security model. But this is a real thing that people worry about, that they want tamper evidence as a security mechanism. So it's good if you can actually check for tampering. And if, you know, avoiding the tamper evidence, making fixing things up so they look the same is not that difficult. Like here, another even problem, like even if you can't forge the stickers, how hard can it be to print a label that looks like this? Maybe that might be a problem with this scheme. That's not a very high cost to your attacker. But the advantage of this sort of level of protection is that it's actually very cheap. That putting something which is hard to break without telling on your device is pretty easy. So the next sort of thing they talk about is tamper resistance. So in tamper resistance, they don't just mean that it's bigger than tamper evidence, because removing the sticker is not hard. Like, you can do it in a couple seconds with a key. So it's not meant to prevent tampering. But things with tamper resistance are doing something where they do expect to actually make it harder to tamper with the device. So to give an example, this is a close-up of that authentication fob that I have in my keychain, same model at least, not mine. And this is what happens after someone does something which you might call tampering with it. Namely, they removed the epoxy-like thing that covers it. And this shows sort of tamper resistance, because doing this is not hard, but it sure isn't amateur-level attack. Right, you need to take out your acetone and dissolve the device in it. That at least for casual things of just picking up the device off the table, or like having access to the device for a minute, you're not going to be able to do this. Also, this shows tamper evidence, because it's pretty obvious when you see this that something happened. That if I look at my key fob and it looks like this, I'm not going to keep using it. It also tells you what's in there, which is two processors, and an LED, and there's stuff on the other side. So tamper resistance, so this sort of layer over the device is a basic form of tamper resistance, and there's other things you might do to try to make it harder to physically get at these chips, for example. And there's other levels of tamper resistance in here, in that this device here is where the secret keys are stored. So if you want to get at the secret keys, in addition to opening up this package, you need to open up this package, which is some additional level of effort that is not trivial to do without damaging the data. So that's tamper resistance. So another thing they talk about is tamper detection. And the distinction between tamper detection and their tamper response is a bit subtle. So sort of the idea of tamper detection is that you add some sort of sensor that's going to tell if your device is tampered with. So maybe you have a sensor that detects whether you've removed the epoxy, or you check whether the code on the device has changed from some known checksum that's stored somewhere else that's hopefully harder to tamper with. You have a switch if, say, a computer case is open. This is a common thing that some old computers have. Switch that with a computer case was open, so you could know that someone tampered with the device. And most importantly, in addition to having a sensor to detect tampering, you actually want it to not be like tamper evidence, where these stickers might be on the device and no one will check them, but the device will alert you that there may have been tampering. So tamper detection is that the device has a sensor to detect it and will also tell you, yes, I think I was maybe tampered with. You might want to do something about that. So the category the paper goes with, that IBM's proposal, is what they call tamper response. So this is basically, they take tamper detection, where they're going to have some sort of sensor to say, yes, it was tampered with. And rather than just showing you a message saying, this device was tampered with, or when you, they're going to actually erase data. That they're going to assume that once it starts being tampered with, that they've lost control of the device, and that they need to make sure that whatever that person is doing stops being useful. And they're going to try to make sure there's no data to recover anymore. So their goal is that when they have tampering, they have some active tamper detection, as it's sometimes called, and they actually erase the data, so it doesn't matter if you actually get access to the memory on the machine, because by the time you do it, unless you were really, really clever, you've tripped the sensor and the data is no longer there. So their assumption is, unlike sort of the tamper detection assumption, is that when you get access to the device, you're going to actually get at the data unless we delete it. So their goal is protecting this data, and they need to detect various kinds of tampering, prevent various kinds of tampering. So one thing they need to worry about is, how do you replace software on the device? They didn't want to have it be programmable. They didn't want to ship a fixed function device, because that's not very commercially useful. That's not very useful if you ever want to upgrade anything ever. So they need some way of allowing you to replace software without losing the device's guarantees. And a problem is that if you can replace software, why can't you replace software that just with software that reads off the secrets happily and lets you get your backup copy of the, you know, master ATM PIN database? And the basic idea that they use is that if you load new software, that part of that loading operation is going to delete the secrets. And this is something that's implemented in their software. So their mini boot needs to guarantee this property, that when you load new software, it deletes old secrets for whatever software was there before. So that means that you can't just replace software with whole new software. Yes, you can load software that's completely new, but you can't get access to what the old, presumably trustworthy software had access to by doing that, even though you're using the same storage it used. Now, this is a reasonable, except that you want to actually update your software. So they wanted to support upgrades where you weren't getting completely new software, but you're just getting an upgrade. And an upgrade, they didn't want to delete the old secrets. And so they used cryptography to do this. So they verify that the new software comes from a trustworthy source. And they used some public key cryptography to do this. So they have a digital signature, which is a public-private key pair. I mentioned this last time. So the public key is basically the identity. And the private key is kept secret by whatever entity is producing signatures using that identity. And the signature says that, yes, someone with this identity actually verified this. And there's a sign operation to get your verification, the thing you can use to say, is this actually true? And the verify operation to say, given that I know someone's key, someone's identity, did they actually make this statement that I have a signature for? And the way they use this is the applications are loaded with a public key. So when you load a new application, it comes with a public key. And when you have an update, it's signed with the corresponding private key. There's a signature over the code. And Miniboot verifies this. And this means that you can't, if you want to load an upgrade to the software, it needs to be signed with this public key you prepared in advance. That I, as Joe Random, can't upgrade that software unless I know the corresponding private key. I can load new software, but it's going to delete its secrets. So their guarantee is that, you know, if you don't use this public key that you provide when you load the software initially, that you're not going to be able to actually keep the secrets around for an upgrade. So questions about this sort of mechanism? Okay, so the other sort of thing they were worried about, besides making sure software came from a trustworthy source, was, you know, keeping you from doing various things to like actually get at the memory in the device directly. Like with a hard drive, you know, if my OS doesn't let you access my hard drive, you're just going to pull it out of my machine and put it in another one. So why can't you do that for the memory in this device? And the key thing they did is that this is the package for the device. That there's this solid thing which is hard to open. And they also were worried about physical manipulation of the device, too, like this. So the solid thing which is hard to open, and here's a picture of it partially opened, so you can see the inside. So you have this mesh layer, it's kind of very visible here, that they talked about, which is the tamper detection layer. So that's something you can't open up the device and get at the memory without tripping that. And you have this layer of aluminum shielding that keeps you from getting at the device in a useful way with various types of electromagnetic signals, or figuring out what the device is doing from electromagnetic signals it's emitting. So another thing besides making sure this packaging didn't let you physically access the memory chips to read what was on them is that they were worried about side channel attacks. So we saw side channel attacks much earlier with cache timing attacks. And there's other sorts of very powerful attacks when you have physical access to a device. So this is an example from a paper that analyzed a smart card, a device with like approximately a credit card size device. And they looked at the amount of energy that was used based on the device, the microcontroller, doing a register write where a certain number of bits changed. And you can see that this is pretty bad. That if there's 0 bits changed versus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you can figure out how many change. And that's a real lot of information. If this is happening on your device, it's really, really hard to write software which is going to keep anything secret. Especially if someone can, as you would have assumed, can know what code you're running. So these sorts of problems are, you know, something that they dealt with, and their solution is the simple hardware solution. They prevent power analysis attacks by basically having a big capacitor so you don't have any useful power signal coming out of the device. And that's in the secure mesh sealed layer, so you can't replace it with something which is less sensitive. That's not really an option on something with a credit card size form factor. That's partially an option. Another thing they were worried about was memory permanence. So we think of SRAM and temporary memory in your computer as going away when you shut it down. But that's not true. Values can persist in memories, even SRAMs, and they don't just go away immediately when they lose power. That's just an electrical property of how they work. So this meant that for erasing their SRAM, they don't just cut power to the SRAM. They have active circuitry that's designed to zero out the SRAM. It's not just a matter of cut power to their device when you think something bad's happening. That's not going to delete the device. And it's actually worse than that because values naturally get burned into SRAM, so they presumably, they don't mention it explicitly, but the correct thing to do is to move values around in the SRAM a little bit in order to prevent that from happening, because you have these secrets that are sitting in your battery-backed RAM all the time. So there are these extra protections in order to make sure the device actually lost the data and didn't leak information through other channels. So they were also concerned about physical manipulations of the device. So for example, I mentioned that RAM that you think of just turning off keeps values around when it loses power. It turns out that if you say, make it really, really cold, it keeps those values around a lot longer. A lot, lot longer. And possibly even over attempts to actively erase them. So there's all these sorts of things. So temperature is one. So decreasing temperature will increase this RAM permanence problem and might make zeroing the data not work before you lose power. Ionizing radiation can apparently stick values in memories. Voltage changing, so if you randomly manipulate voltages, you can either, you can change what the memory does or you can change what the CPU does, and that might end up, like, say, copying a secret instead of doing a calculation with it somewhere or something like that, and you might be able to figure out something about the secrets or have the software produce a very incorrect result. And they were all like changing clock signals. And their primary way of dealing with this is fairly direct. Since they're building hardware, they don't need to do anything funny to detect this. They just have sensors. So they have a temperature sensor, which in particular means that these devices are hard to ship, because they will break themselves if you try to ship them at the wrong temperature. They have a radiation sensor. They have an actual sensor for ionizing radiation. So if you aim ionizing radiation at the device, it will zero its memory. And they have a voltage sensor. So if, in addition to buffering its power to hide those signals, if you try to manipulate its power too much, it might trigger the temperature circuitry and zero the device. And they had some extra circuitry to make sure the clock signals worked out correctly. So any questions on these sort of countermeasures? Yeah.
How did they deal with thermal management? Because I didn't see any like exhaust ports when
I fan. I don't know the details. I assume the idea is that just that it's that they don't use a processor which is power hungry enough. I believe the device has basically sort of an embedded class PowerPC processor. inside, which probably doesn't use that much power. An observation to make is that they're not aiming for high performance. The idea is you only do your really sensitive calculations. And typically, when people talk about hardware security modules, the sort of performance they quote is not much more than a low-end CPU, low-end server CPU. This is less true in newer devices. And often, the performance they quote, they have like specialized hardware on their CPU for like making RSA faster, like to aid modular arithmetic, which means that it's even easier to compete with normal CPU. Other questions, comments? So I thought I'd give a brief diversion. So I'm not an expert on attacking these things, but it's worth noting that people who physically attack hardware are a lot more clever than you think. So this is a picture from a paper attacking a different device. And you see this weird mesh thing. And that weird mesh thing is something very similar to the mesh that they described in the IBM paper, but just on a different piece of hardware. So they had some sort of detector mesh on a chip, an individual chip. And the idea is that if you short out any of these lines, that you trigger some tamper circuitry, and the chip stops working. And here you see that someone used a focused ion beam, so a particle beam, to very carefully drill a hole right there, which happens to be where a bus line is. So they can stick a very, very thin metal tip and read the values off the bus line. And they managed to do this without breaking this mesh.
Where did that occur?
This is a paper by Comerling and Kahn, who are from UK.
So it's like a research experiment.
This is a research paper. But it's worth knowing that this is in the budget for people who are grad students. So if you're building a commercial device, you should maybe think hard about what you need to actually defend against and whether it's worth it. So there's lots of clever things you can do, and there's other sorts of attacks on these devices. As far as I know, the IBM device, I'm not aware of anyone in actually figuring out an effective practical way of getting at the device, and Ross Anderson's group at Cambridge tried, so it's probably actually pretty hard. But you should be aware that like it's cheaper than you think. Like it's not like attacking one of these devices involves first you need to figure out how to mechanically remove this mesh. That's not what you actually do. You take a shortcut. Yeah.
So what kind of like security measures are like root CAs employing
to protect their keys? Well, I mean, so the hope is that in the root CA or bank environment, that someone who walks into your machine room, takes out your HSM and puts it in a focused ion beam device, is probably going to get caught. Also, like the IBM device is not, you actually need to do more work than on this device. You need to remove the first layer, and they have some podding to make it harder than this device, which this is just on the, I think just like a layer on the die or something like that. So it's not as sensitive. There's other factors which affect the difficulty, like if you have, like feature size matters a lot. Like it's much more annoying to do this for a processor with like a 20 nanometer process than like a 50 or 100 for obvious reasons, just because that beam is a certain size. So it's not impossible, but I think the reason I have this is I want to point out that your attackers are not going to do the brute force method. So a lot of people sort of have this impression that what they're going to do is they're going to take their scanning electron microscope and they're going to reverse engineer your whole chip. They're going to like figure out all the gates, And that's how they're going to go about figuring out your hardware. That is, or reading your SRAM. They're going to take out their electron microscope and probe the signals everywhere. And they're going to need to sand down all your components above that due to the tamper detection. That is not what they're going to do. They're like going to figure out where the interesting bus line that the signal with the secret goes across, and they're going to find it and figure out the fastest way to get to it. And this seems to be often forgotten about people who talk casually about designing secure hardware, or systems that use secure hardware. So another big thing the paper talks about, which is in a different topic, is attestation. So I don't think they used the word, but attestation means some mechanism to know what code is running somewhere. Some way to prove that I can prove to you that I am running software X and not some software Y. And this was important for the IBM device because they wanted to know if you loaded code on the device, did someone replace it? Did someone replace your ATM card management software with ATM card management software with added features to dump the PIN database? They want some way of verifying that. And the mechanism that IBM used for this is that they had a private key that was loaded onto the device at the factory. And loading code signs this message, which says, yes, I loaded this application, and also I gave it a key pair. Here's the public key, and I gave it the private key for this public key. And by having this signed message, you can know that, yes, it was actually loaded onto the device. Now, that's not enough. But the key part here is that this includes a public card of a key pair. So to actually authenticate the software, use this what is called a certificate, a signed message giving you a public key. And the application signs something for you. Like the PIN software signs, yes, I really have, yes, I really computed that this is the PIN you looked up. So it signs a message saying, yeah, I really computed that for you with the corresponding private key. And because you have that certificate, you know that the software you got that message from is actually the software you think is supposed to be running, and not some other software. So the idea here is that it's not just that we have a signature saying, yes, I loaded it, because you could just copy that signature and send it later. But it's that we use that information in that to verify the actual computation that happens. And as a diversion, I'll talk about a modern use case that people want for attestation. Let's say I run a VM on Amazon Web Services. They provide me rental VMs that are remote. And wouldn't it be nice if I could verify that Amazon is really running my code? And wouldn't it be even nicer if I could verify that Amazon's running my code in a way where they can't get at my data? And this is a real thing people want. And the IBM paper gives you the sort of idea of how you might, get at this sort of goal, at least the first one, with if you trusted someone who made Amazon's hardware but didn't trust Amazon. And if we have a computing environment which keeps secrets secret like that, it also tells you how you keep Amazon from getting your data. In particular, something you should know about cryptography is that given this public key that I know I can, that SAB messages sign with, I can also use that to set up an encrypted channel. So I can send messages to this application that only this application that I know was correctly loaded can read. And this gives me a way that if I have secure memory my correctly loaded application can access, I can send things to it and know that nothing else, assuming the hardware is okay, can read it. So this seems like a very pie-in-the-sky sort of use case that's not really what IBM's device is designed for. But it turns out that this is being explored commercially. In particular, Intel has a CPU extension called SGX, which provides what they call secure enclaves on a CPU. So they provide this remote attestation feature and this secure secrets feature on a normal CPU. So the model is pretty similar to the IBM stuff, except that you're actually running untrusted software and trusted software and your secure stuff on the same machine. That Intel hasn't taken the step to make things easier to understand of only going down in privilege and having secrets that never get off the device that way, but just does some mode switching that switches between some secure device and untrusted stuff. But the idea is that if you trust Intel, that Intel has made it so you can get something that tells you, yes, you're actually running this software on an Intel chip, if you trust Intel. And you can get that in spite of whatever this untrusted software here is, installed by whoever's owns the machine. And the idea is that you can use this to, if you own some data, compute on that data on the remote machine and do so securely, assuming you trust Intel. So SGX is trying to do something much harder than what the IBM paper is doing, in that they are running on the same CPU as a malicious operating system. They didn't take this ratcheting approach of only going down in privilege to keep things simple, but they have to reason about everything that OS, which gets to run normally, gets to do. So they have their CPU enforce protecting these secure containers here from the operating system, which is part of the untrusted software. So the operating system gets to run, but it doesn't get to look at what the secure container is doing or interfere with it. So they're doing the same isolation stuff in hardware. And one way of looking at this is that effectively, the CPU microcode is kind of an OS, which enforces protection between two kinds of applications, normal operating systems and the secure enclaves. And like, for example, the OS doesn't get to control memory, this means. But you need to have some way where the OS actually still manages the memory overall. So the mechanism for that is that you communicate with a sort of microcode OS by saying, here's a page I would like to give to the enclave, here's a page I'd like to take back from the enclave. And when you take a page back, it gets encrypted so you can't read it. So it's safe for the OS to do that. So SGX deals with the software side of things. We can do all our normal OS mechanisms, but with microcode enforcing, microcode running instead of normal operating system. Microcode being basically just some code on the processor itself. That's sort of a minimal OS for this. The other side is physical attacks. And SGX actually tries to protect against physical attacks on the system. And the biggest concern is, why can't I just read the data in memory with another device? Why can't I just hook something up to my DRAM chip and read it? And their solution at Intel is memory encryption. That they encrypt all data in memory. So the idea is that everything that gets off the chip is insecure. That's their assumption. So rather than having this big case surrounding all the important stuff like the IBM approach was, they just assume that everything outside of the chip, possibly even outside of the core on the chip, is insecure, and everything out of there is encrypted if it contains sensitive data. So a big problem with this, though, that thing is something that SGX doesn't really deal with, that the IBM stuff certainly does, is side channels. SGX's story for side channels is basically they don't do anything. That if you want to resist side channel attacks, like power analysis, you need to do it yourself. And this is actually very concerning because as the operating system, you could do a lot of weird stuff to observe what the program is doing, even though it's executing in a separate enclave. Like you can arrange for a timer interrupt to happen very, very, very frequently and see what's happening and try to figure out what's happening. You can change its memory, you can make it so it has only one page allocated at a time and figure out exactly what page of memory it's accessing every instruction. So there's a lot of visibility, much more so than in the cache timing paper we read, which should be pretty concerning. But the main physical security story, the sort of hope, is that because Intel processors have a very small feature size relative to what we've seen before, that attacks that try to physically read that key should be difficult. And moreover, the value of physically reading the key is only if you can actually, you know, keep using it, which might be, you know, which means that if you read one, you have one device that you can fake being, but not like 1,000. So any questions about SGX in general? So it's something I wanted to bring up because it's probably the biggest sort of attempt at hardware security stuff which is happening recently. And some researchers are very excited about it. Some are very skeptical of it as far as applicability. And sort of, there's two big problems with it. So one is you have to trust Intel. And if you look at the details of implementation, perhaps more than you might think. The other sort of issue is that it has this tension where you don't really control as much as you might think what you run on your machine because you have this capability, which makes some people nervous about it. But I think it's important to be aware about because it may or may not become important in the future. And certainly some people think it enables you to do the sort of cloud security things that are very exciting. That maybe you can, you know, rent out computers and not need to really, really trust that, you know, your cloud provider is doing their job. So I thought I'd also mention some active things I know are research areas in hardware security that are basically unsolved problems. Since a lot of people remarked that the paper that we read looked like everything's solved. And it's true for that sort of form factor device, it is, pretty much. Like, there's not changing very much. IBM still sells a successor to this device in the paper that uses PCI Express. It's a commercially successful product, and there are competitors. So one question is hardware verification. So it's not something I talked about at all, but it's a very important question for many people. So I think this is particularly a thing like United States military agencies are concerned about. A lot of their hardware is manufactured in places they don't really trust. They would like some way of actually knowing that they got the hardware they thought they ordered. So how can you, given a physical piece of hardware, verify that you actually have the chip you think you have and not some chip which is designed to operate incorrectly under some circumstances or release some secrets under some circumstances? Another question is sort of what SGX is trying to solve. It's actually safely running sensitive code on the same hardware in a way that's usable and efficient. That's still like an area of, you know, interesting research. And I think there's probably still more to be done as far as hardware support to help with operating system level security in general. To help, you know, do sandboxing, memory protection, to do high level language sort of checks to make that more efficient. There's probably still more room for hardware to help people do that efficiently. And that might be an area of research. And another thing which is underexplored is we talked about side channels. So SGX's solution to side channel is just basically, don't deal with them. And this device dealt with some side channels, but through very sort of expensive mechanisms like encasing something in a podding and having a big capacitor to high voltage signals. And it'd be nice to have maybe some hardware techniques which make it less likely you get those sort of leakages with a substantially less cost. That's all I have for today. So people are asking about the exam, and I'd like to spend next week reviewing things for the exam. Sometime by tomorrow, I will put out a survey asking you what topics you'd like me to cover next week. I hope to have a sort of practice exam, which will be composed of whatever exam questions I write and don't use. I haven't written the full exam yet, so I don't have that yet, but I do want to release that by sometime next week, or ideally earlier, ideally like Friday or Saturday. So to give you an idea, like what sort of questions will be on the exam. But I'll try to put out a survey asking, like, for each thing on the list of exam topics, do you really want me to cover this? It would be nice to cover. Would prefer you not cover, definitely don't cover, that sort of thing. Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.